The following pilot tape is designed to illustrate a proposed monthly service available by subscription to all members of the IEEE. The interviews are simulated.
Data, devices, and designs.
The three D's, dialogue and information.
Presented by the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers on behalf of its 162,000 members.
I'm John Wolfe.
I'm Jim Harriet.
Reporting to you on the timely, the varied, and the ever-exciting challenges faced by our leading engineers in their ceaseless quest for technological progress.
New York City, home of the Mets and headquarters of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, rolled out its fabled red carpet for the annual IEEE convention, which took over the city's huge Coliseum as its exhibition grounds and the multiple ballrooms of the renowned New York Hilton for its lecture podiums.
For today's space-minded society, a session on working and living in space is a surefire attraction. As participants for this panel, IEEE lined up many of the foremost authorities in the field. Session chairman was the famed Wernher von Braun, now director of the Marshall Space Flight Center, NASA, Huntsville. Von Braun captured the attention of his audience immediately.
Despite the fantastic technical achievements of the Apollo 7, Apollo 8, and Apollo 9 missions, we still have some very basic human problems of living and working in space. The usefulness of an Earth orbital space station is one of the most widely discussed facets of space flight today.
Commenting next on what life aboard one of these manned space stations would be like, the famed speaker said,
because of the uniqueness of weightlessness in the space environment, the potential even for manufacturing in space has been reviewed in some depth.
Von Braun described the possibility of 50 or more persons living and working aboard such a space station.
And spoke also of artificial gravity, which might be provided to make Earth beings feel more at home.
As regards the cost of transporting people back and forth to the space station, Von Braun had this to say.
Many groups, including the President's Scientific Advisory Group, say in essence, NASA should make it its first and foremost business to reduce orbital transportation cost.
One way to reduce such transportation costs, according to the famed Space Authority, would be the use of a low-cost launching vehicle. However, Von Braun emphasized most emphatically that any such development must be done without any lowering of NASA's established standards of reliability and safety. In closing, the speaker declared that even the most advanced automated space station could not long exist without the presence of man to direct it, and added humorously,
putting a man up into space will actually be cheaper than trying to use automated equipment. It has been rightfully stated that man is still, by all odds, the fastest, most capable computer that can be manufactured with unskilled labor in quantity production.
The next speaker to describe the responses of man living in space was Douglas Lord of the National Aeronautical Center in Washington, D.C., commenting that the capability to conduct manned operations in outer space held top priority among the fundamental objectives of the space program. Mr. Lord declared,
"We have now been actively engaged in manned Earth orbital activities for over 7 years. From the Mercury program, which first launched Americans into orbit, we learned that there was no inherent reason that man could not exist and work in space when he was given the proper protective systems that he needed. In the following Gemini program, we verified that man could remain in a weightless condition for up to 14 days without serious debilitation. Of equal significance to a space station thinking, however, is the fact that we were able to rendezvous and dock spacecraft, which is a necessary prelude to orbital assembly. This technique is essential to sustain space station operations. New crews, expendables, and experiments will be supplied to the station from the ground by periodic launches of a rendezvousing spacecraft. Although the orbital tests performed to date with the Apollo systems have been aimed primarily at qualifying the equipment for the forthcoming lunar landing, some significant contributions have been made toward a space station design. The Apollo spacecraft, which contains nearly 6 times as much pressurized volume as the Gemini spacecraft, is the first vehicle large enough to allow the crew to freely move about for reasonable periods of time.
It's said that a man's home is his castle. How about his future castle in space? Mr. Lord has this to say about getting acclimated.
We found that the crew rapidly learned that in space, moving about the spacecraft was much easier than it had been on the ground. The Apollo crew reported that they could restrain themselves with only minimal holds. We have concluded that crew motions in a zero-G environment will not require the extensive restraints or handholds originally thought necessary, and that the zero-G environment may facilitate rather than hinder motion. On the other hand, it has been proposed, as Dr. Von Braun mentioned, by several people and actively supported by many, that some level of artificial gravity may eventually be required in space, if not for physiological reasons, then for just convenience.
In conclusion, Dr. Lord said,
the basic character of the space station program in NASA is that of a step-by-step growth, each new step capitalizing upon the results of the prior steps.
Among the panelists on this exciting session on outer space was a man who had really been there, astronaut Wally Cunningham. Mr. Cunningham, whose background includes that of a research scientist, holds a master's degree in physics. Also, he's a flyer and a major in the Marine Corps. Speaking from first-hand experience, Major Cunningham commented,
I think it's pretty important to make a distinction, as a matter of fact, between existing in space and living in space. As far as I'm concerned, the primary, most significant accomplishment of the Gemini program was the flight of Gemini 7. In that particular flight, Frank Borman and Jim Lovell existed for 14 days. And that really took an awful lot of fortitude. When we got to the Apollo spacecraft, we started a new generation of vehicles in which you could get up and move around. That makes a world of difference.
Also enthused about the challenge of the space station was Dr. E.Z. Gray of Grumman Aircraft, who contributed this opinion.
We've been doing quite a bit of work trying to decide which is the way for the future growth of these modules. I think we're tending to believe more and more as we look into the problem that this circular wheel type of an arrangement is more adaptable to the kind of program which could grow within the budgetary type constraints that the government will operate in.
So there you have it, John, a very interest-arousing and informative session on living and working in space.
Not all of us, Jim, are likely to personally participate in technological advances in outer space, but we are closely concerned with the manner in which this computer-dominated age can affect our lives and our health right here on Earth.
Right, John. And so the convention session on automation for health was extremely well attended and listened attentively as keynote speaker Dr. G.S. Cohen declared,
skillfully applied, automation can increase productivity of doctors, nurses, aides, clerks, and administrators.
Dr. Cohen then referred to a paper by Dr. D.B. Waxman, director of the National Center for Health Services located at Alexandria, Virginia, and gave this description of what is being done.
The center, by means of grants and contracts, supports, promotes, and stimulates a national program of health services, research and development, and demonstrations, including applying and refining computer technology in screening, automating medical records, and selected other aspects of the medical care process.
Enthusiasm for the role of the computer was expressed in these words.
With such a tool, a human investigator potentially becomes a giant. The limitation of his investigatory range is no longer time or complexity, but his own ability, intuition, and imagination for defining and structuring his problem for computer-aided analysis.
There will never be a substitute for human judgment. That, too, was emphasized by the next speaker, Dr. George N. Webb of Johns Hopkins Hospital, who praised the computer for its role in funding knowledge about each new patient, but insisted that the records provided by such computers be properly understood and administered by those employing them.
If you are going to take a record, and that record is going to last more than 5 minutes, and you have another record either in series or in parallel, you need to automatically identify that record.
Dr. Webb gave us an example of the case of a nurse whose monitoring station was a very busy one and who may be called away by some emergency. When she returns, it is difficult for her to remember which data applied to which patient. Dr. Webb suggested that manufacturers should understand the problems and provide necessary safeguards and improvements.
To you in the manufacturing industrial area, you need to have an active participation in delivery of medical care so that you are not just taking paper specifications without really knowing what is required. Produce an operations manual so that at 2 o'clock in the morning, when something has happened and some other goofball has turned every switch in the wrong direction, a person who is not too familiar with it can get the system back in operation.
The next speaker, Dr. W.R. Kirkham of Perth Amboy General Hospital, agreed with what had been said.
I might emphasize Mr. Webb's latter points there, that the manufacturer should get some experience working in a medical environment, in a direct health service environment. We have worked for the past 2.5 years with a small computer manufacturer, Spear Computers Incorporated, in developing a clinical laboratory computer system. And the gentleman from the firm actually spent at least half of their time with us in the laboratory on the system.
Dr. Kirkham then went on to describe what such a laboratory should resemble.
A system should be designed so it is part of the laboratory equipment itself. It should handle the entire data, the lab data load. It should be easily interfaced with existing equipment. It should be readily adaptable to most laboratories. In other words, in this point, many laboratories operate about the same. So that if you can design a system that will operate in one laboratory, it will operate in a large number of laboratories with only moderate modifications.
So, Jim, the session on automated healthcare concluded on a note of optimism.
Apparently, even the small hospital may find a computerized lab within the realm of possibility.
Speaking of possibility leads, of course, into the ever-new possibilities to be experienced by communications and the computer.
Small wonder that this matter was given high priority in programming sessions of the IEEE convention. Session Chairman D.C. Evans of the University of Utah directed attention to the important link between computers and communication with these words.
There was a time when one could distinguish several different information processing activities which were distinct. The transmission of information from one person to another was called communication. And there were highly repetitive but routine processing of data tasks where the data was represented by holes in punch cards. And this activity was something carried on by business establishments mainly. And then there were engineering and scientific computations. Since those innocent days, there have been a number of complicating developments. The business data processor has tried to expand his machine boundary by means of communication lines for the purposes of acquiring the information in the same system that processes it. This is achieved by connecting communication lines physically to the locations at which the transactions take place. Companies have tried to link their various facilities together so that there are computers here and there which are connected to a central machine, thus providing machine-machine linkages.
Continuing on this theme of machine-to-machine languages, the next speaker, Dr. S.E. Estes of IBM, inquired,
communication requirements for computers. If I were to ask, say, 12 people out of the audience for an answer to that question, no doubt I would have 12 answers. And one of the reasons why I would have 12 answers is that those 12 individuals are looking at it from a different viewpoint or a different background or different problems that they have encountered.
Dr. Estes then illustrated by picking a hypothetical company, one scattered through a large area, and involved in using certain data processing services in its day-to-day activities. He detailed the survey that such a company would make as to the feasibility of linking up existing hardware into a communications network. On the latter point, he had this to say.
It depends on the characteristics of those applications that are being served or the data processing services being offered, on the collective and the individual characteristics of those applications. In order to obtain efficiency, we have to be able to handle and to characterize accurately the message traffic. We want to know who talks to who. That is, what users are addressing what services.
Dr. Estes added that it would be desirable to have users talk to users and data processing centers to each other.
Which brings us right back to machines talking to machines.
The next speaker, Mr. Gerald Estrin of UCLA, might be considered a pessimist. Anyway, he saw some bottlenecks in this whole structure of communications and the computer, and applied part of his criticism to the part played by universities in the development of communication computer techniques.
The campuses are big businesses. We don't just talk about a research environment. There's a large commercial effort going on in the administration of these organizations. Aside from this big business and management aspect, you have the gamut of activities in teaching and attempting to train people to meet the impossible needs of the future.
In conclusion, Professor Estrin did this philosophizing.
There really has been a very extensive development of basic modules so that a man can sit down and design almost anything that he wants. In fact, the deepest problem that he has is one of decision. You know, which set of modules to put together. Right now, there are no good guidelines for making those decisions, and it's an art.
For this session, Bell Labs were represented by a team of two speakers. The first of the two, Mr. R.W. Lucky, borrowed from an old vaudeville routine and described himself as the front end of the horse. Lucky had an amusing battering style which brought chuckles from the audience on many occasions. Discussing transmission problems in general and higher speeds in particular, Lucky declared,
"There are obviously two ways that you can get higher speeds in data transmission. You can either, we're sending information by pulses, and you can either send more pulses per second, or you can let each pulse represent more information."
The speaker admitted, however, that there were limits to the number of pulses you could send. Beyond that,
well, you run into troubles, because the more of these amplitude levels you try to put in, the harder they get to distinguish at the receiver. And the things that get in the way of our distinguishing the pulses are noise in the telephone facilities, which is really quite low, and so I'm told to say. And the other thing is the self-noise that the pulses themselves create because they get a little bit distorted in going through a telephone line.
Mr. Lucky's partner, Mr. Warren Cornell, also from Bell Labs, was not as facetious, but equally interesting, as he said.
Current studies are yielding very useful traffic information on the design of systems. We're learning something about macroscopic things like calling rates and holding times, but more important, we're learning something about the microscopic information, the details of the characteristics of the information flow, the effects of computer load on traffic flow, the effects of computer scheduling algorithms.
Mr. Cornell went on to say that as part of the studies, Bell Labs had made extensive measurements on four interactive, time-saving commercial systems with an analysis of more than 20,000 pieces of information over four different systems.
The results were good. Needs that had been expressed seemed to be answered. Mr. Cornell referred repeatedly to what representatives of business were asking for and how Bell Laboratories were fulfilling the need. He highlighted his remarks with the mention of the picture phone.
Now we have under development a 6-megabit system, which we call T2, which will have extensive use for picture phone. As you may know, picture phone is now under product trial here in New York and in Pittsburgh for Westinghouse Corporation.
John, wasn't it a picture phone that they exhibited at the New York World's Fair?
That's so, Jim, but this, of course, is much more of an advanced design, as Mr. Cornell indicated.
There are two aspects of picture phone I'd like to mention that I think are related to data. One is you're going to transmit picture phone long distance on a digital network in a digital format. That same network can handle high-speed data, and we're carrying on the development such that it'll be possible to have a data phone equivalent of picture phone, let us say, where you dial a picture phone call, but what you really want to do is send data. And this we can accommodate on the same network at speeds which now looks to us between 1 and 2 megabits. So we're now talking about three kinds of switch services, those down in the few kilobit range on straight data phone, those in the 50 kilobit range, and the coming megabit range switch services.
So, John, here's looking at you.
Over the new picture phone, of course. As was true of many of the sessions at the IEEE convention, the audience had a chance to ask questions. In reply to one question that criticized manufacturers because of the time lag in getting new developments marketable and on the shelf, Professor Estrin gave this appraisal.
I believe that we would see a rather sharp increase in the kind of innovations that are available to us in devices if potentially new manufacturers or old manufacturers going into new devices weren't unsure of themselves about what they would be allowed to do, by the regulatory commissions.
Speaking to the same question, E.E. David Jr., Executive Director of Research at Bell Labs, commented,
"The timescale is somewhat dependent on need and market and how you're being pushed."
Then he added rather jocularly,
"I like stuff to be available off the shelf, but I'm a little unhappy with the idea of engineering systems this way. It puts me in mind of a military conference I went to several years ago, and we gave a talk on the need for systems engineering. Knowing what you're going to do, what the problems are, what the quantities are, and then engineering a system to meet this. And there were a lot of nodding heads, people seemed to be understanding and appreciating this. And then one hard-bitten old colonel got up and he says, 'What the hell is all this systems engineering stuff? All you do is you build the best components you can build and you throw them together and they work.'"
Certainly not a very appreciative reaction.
Nor a very understanding one.
We'll have more highlights from this lively IEEE convention later on. But now it's time for a very special feature, a timely interview with a young engineer who has an exciting story to tell about LSI, large-scale integration. We'll take you to California to meet Mr. Joseph Campo following this commercial message.
Right now, IEEE has a new and special offer to give you a vacation from the never-ending task of keeping up to date on the latest in information for members of the engineering profession. IEEE offers two new publications designed to keep you informed, yet save endless time and energy. These are high-value, low-cost, current awareness services and are expressly designed to meet your personal needs. Publication 1, titled Current Papers in Electrical and Electronics Engineering, CPE, is a bibliography in 12 issues annually. The yearly subscription for IEEE members is only $9, a tremendous value. The second of these two new awareness services is titled Current Papers on Computers and Control, CPC, and the yearly subscription rate for 12 issues annually is only $6. Remember, more than 1,200 publications are scanned to bring you these summaries. More than 90 publications are covered completely in the services offered here. In the current papers in electrical and electronics engineering, you'll find over 34,000 listings, and in computers and control, more than 16,000 listings. So give yourself a vacation from the impossible task of covering all this information on your own. Let IEEE do the job for you effectively and efficiently. For minimal overlap, subscribe now to both of IEEE's great new current awareness services.
A recent Air Force-sponsored R&D program involving the use of LSI, large-scale integration, has attracted attention. To learn more of the problems encountered in attempts to use LSI in real systems, John Wolfe goes now to Woodland Hills, California, to call upon Mr. James Campo, of the technical staff of Litton Guidance and Control Systems. Mr. Campo, who obtained his B.S. at Case Institute and his M.S. at UCLA, is young, dedicated, well-informed. John faces him with this question.
Mr. Campo, I'm here today to talk to you about LSI and array processing and the part that you and Litton Guidance have had in its development. When did such a project get started?
We at Litton have been working on in large-scale integration for the last 4 years, approximately. We have several digital computers under development at this time.
Is everything going according to plan? I can see from your expression it's not.
The thing that you don't appreciate originally is the difficulty of making changes in the artwork, that is, the effect of mistakes.
I imagine those of us who have never had close identification with LSI have a meager knowledge of such difficulties.
You can't appreciate it until you get into it. All along the way, you have mistakes, not only of your digital system, but also of the artwork manufacturer, of the mask maker, and then finally having the wafers come back.
Forgive me for interrupting, Mr. Campo, but that word wafer... A wafer seems like something magic to me. Would you tell us something about it?
Silicon wafer. It's made from a large cylindrical ingot. You slice a thin blank. In the most commonly used process in the industry today, the silicon blank is first coated with a resistive material, which is then exposed using the mask, the exposure then admits light to certain regions on the resist.
With, I assume, very rewarding consequences.
The simultaneous development of thousands and thousands of transistors all at the same time.
That's almost beyond comprehension. To me, that is, not to you.
We have a yield evaluation wafer now that contains over 200,000 transistors, basically shift registers, and it was put together for the purposes of determining what types of yields could be obtained from this basic wafer. In the normal manufacturing process, this wafer, after the basic diffusions and depositions and so forth, will be tested.
And after such testing, what then?
About 95% of the industry will then dice that wafer up into little pieces of confetti. And the bad pieces are thrown away, and the good pieces are then mounted.
But your approach at Litton is different in what way?
The approach that we've taken attempts to use the entire wafer without dicing it up, without using extra processing steps in terms of extra layers of metal.
That is fascinating, Mr. Campo. I wonder if you'd give us some details about Litton's R&D project for the Air Force.
A specific program we've had with the Air Force since January of 1967, developing a kind of computer called an array processor. Large-scale integration imposes certain constraints on its use. It's the problem of trying to minimize the number of leads entering and leaving your devices. It's also the problem of trying to use devices which contain imperfections.
Perhaps you'd say something about the Iliad 4 program.
The Iliac 4 program was to handle problems which, by their very magnitude, were too large for the conventional single-processor machine to handle. The second reason for going to parallel or array processing is that certain problems, by their very nature, lend themselves to mechanization of this sort.
When might this apply? Could you give us some examples?
For example, a traffic control problem or a radar data processing problem, radar digital filters, a lens, radar lens pointing. The third reason for going to array processing is the unique requirements that large-scale integration puts on the system. And that was the reason we went to it in this case, because we were able to put our computer on these large wafers. The initial application that we're developing it for the Air Force is for the guidance and control of a air-to-surface missile.
Thank you, Mr. Campo. Chatting with you has been informative and exciting. We'll return to New York City and another very lively and provocative session of the IEEE convention.